Rev up your engines, Junkions. It's time for another episode of Junk Food Cinema, brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com.
Vroom vroom.
Dot General Motors. I am your. This is, of course, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast. So good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host. He's a novelist, he's a screenwriter, he's a lieutenant of Megaforce. He's made the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs, but only behind the wheel of a Corvette Stingray, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
How's it going?
It's going well. I'm interested this week. This is a...
That's good, because every other week, clearly from listening to the recordings, you could not care less.
Well, no. Usually I'm like, I'm really excited about this week. This week I'm like... I'm interested.
Yeah, this may
this,
be.
This is your week. You picked this one, and I like this movie.
Yeah.
This movie is interesting.
It's very strange. It's an oddball movie. It's one that I would wager most of you listening to this have not seen. It's not super easy to get your hands on because it was never released on DVD. So you either watch it, you can rent it from a streaming service, which is great. I was very surprised that so many had it, but you cannot really purchase it anywhere. But yeah, we'll get into that in just a minute. If you want to hear more of our rambling, you can always go to Blog Talk Radio or iTunes. If you do go to iTunes, if you leave us a 5-star rating and a review, we'd really appreciate that. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. I feel like we interact a lot. In fact, our producer Merrill reached out to me today apropos of nothing, and he's just like, wow, the listener engagement on social media is really great. And I was like, oh, thanks. Because that's just me bullshitting with people. So if you'd like to do that too, at Junk Food Cinema on Twitter, we'd appreciate that. At Facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. And if you really like the show.
I mean, really like the show.
If you like the show more than Mark Hamill apparently loves fine automobiles, you can go to Patreon.com/Junk Food Cinema. And for as little as a dollar an episode, you get access to bonus content that nobody else gets to hear. And this week, we're continuing Summer of 78.
With a movie that we probably should have kicked it off with, since it's got summer in the title.
It has summer in the title, and has been one of my deep-fried, long-lost favorites for a long time. I adore this movie. This is a movie called Corvette Summer.
It's the car of a lifetime. It took him all year to build it.
Hell, I'm going to drive that thing right up to General Motors' front door.
One night to lose it.
Hey, that's my car! You stole my car!
And the whole summer to get it back. MGM presents Corvette Summer.
Somebody stole my Stingray. The word's out, it's Vegas.
You got a Corvette?
Starring Mark Hamill, who's back from Star Wars.
Oh, yeah!
And Annie Potts, who's out of this world.
You love them dead, sailor. Let me see what you got.
He's into fast cars.
Why don't you write a letter to the car? Dear car.
She's into black velvet.
Beg your pardon?
I believe. Wow!
Together, they find love.
You have no right to take me anywhere!
Excitement. And danger. On the trail of a stolen Corvette.
Stop this car! Stop it! I'm getting out!
Oh, no, you're not!
Mark Hamill, Annie Potts. It's the girl.
Oh, you're insane!
The car and the time that separates the men from the boys. Corvette Summer.
It's a terrific car.
A fiberglass romance.
A movie that, by the way, has one of its posters has one of my favorite taglines of all time.
And what is that?
It is Mark Summer, the man you'll remember from Star Wars.
Mark Hamill.
Mark, yes.
Mark Summer's hosted Double Dare, by the way.
Yeah, Mark Summer's. Mark Hamill, the man you'll remember from Star Wars, and Annie Potts, the girl you'll never forget. Because it's like, oh yeah, she's not actually been in anything, so...
No, but she is unstoppably cute in this movie.
Well, she was always unstoppably cute. Like, Annie Potts was always amazing. But this is young, fresh-faced, right off the bus Annie Potts. along with young, fresh-faced, hot off of being a Tatooine farm boy, Mark Hamill, pre-accident Mark Hamill.
Yes.
Like, this is right before he would have the accident that would lead to them having to write an entire whole extra section into Empire Strikes Back to explain why Luke Skywalker's face is all fucked up.
If you would like to know why he's attacked by a Wampa at the beginning of Empire Strikes Back, there was a logistical purpose for it. It wasn't just to make another monster. Although, frankly, I don't care because the Wampa attack and that whole
thing. That scene feels like it, that whole thing feels like it belongs there.
Yeah.
It's so well done. He was the young hot superstar that was riding a motorcycle and Space Dad took a spill.
And buckle up, fuzzballs, because there will be probably a lot of Star Wars talk in this episode for various reasons, not the least of which being the star of this movie is Mark Hamill.
Is Space Dad.
The Force is strong in this one.
Mark Hamill in this movie playing a high school senior who's only... The only thing he really cares about in school is his auto shop class.
He's failing out of school.
He's not doing great, but he's taken solace in the fact that the one class that really brings him joy, that he can really throw his passion into, is the auto shop class, where they are actually doing a project where they're restoring an old car. So this movie
opens... Because he's in the advanced auto shop class.
Yes, advanced auto parts class, where he can find you all the spark plugs in aisle 7. He and his class at the beginning of this movie are at a dump, and they're just looking for the car that they're going to restore. And he happens to look up and see that they are on a crane dragging to the crusher the chassis of a 76 Corvette Stingray. And I want to say this right off the bat. I think I've said this in our Fast and the Furious episodes. I am not a gearhead. By any stretch of the imagination. I know very, very little about cars. However, I have been multiple times to the Corvette Museum in Bowling Green, Kentucky. And my grandfather has owned multiple Corvettes are like the only car I really give a shit about on any personal level. So that already was a great in with me that this movie had.
Corvettes are the first car I ever learned how to steal.
I'm sorry, what now?
That was the first car I ever learned how to steal.
And you're just going to drop that like it doesn't require a backstory? Sure. Yeah. Let's just drive right by that.
I had my own Corvette summer when I was about 12 years old. I went to spend the summer up in upstate New York with a bunch of my family, and I bounced around to various relatives for the summer. And one of my relatives, my uncle, was a repo man. And had his own repo business. And so he's like, well, if you're going to stay here, you're going to learn the job. And so he taught me how to repo cars. And one time he backed up a Corvette. He goes, all right, this is going to be fun. I'm going to show you this because this is one of the harder cars and easiest cars to steal. And he showed me how to steal a Corvette, which involves you having to take the steering wheel off because of the way it was designed to be anti-theft. But he showed me how to do it, and then he put it back together, and he's like, all right, here's the tools, steal this Corvette. And so when I was 12 years old, I learned how to steal a Corvette. And so every time I've heard the title Corvette Summer, I'm always reminded of that time I was 12 and hung out with my uncle, the repo guy.
Steal a Corvette. Shouldn't have taught Cargill. That's amazing. That I feel like every time I do one of these episodes with you and I learn a little bit about your past, so much shit makes sense. And it's always surprising, but at the same time, it all kind of makes sense. But yes, Mark Hamill plays Kenny Dantley, who notices that the Corvette is being dragged to the crusher and starts screaming at Have you noticed this about young screaming Mark Hamill?
The shrieking girlish nature of it?
He sounds a lot like Curtis Armstrong when he's screaming. He sounds a lot like Booger from Revenge of the Nerds.
Yeah?
It was very strange to me. But he manages
to... Uncle Owen, I want to go to the Tashi Station and get some power.
Never gonna get off this rock. Yeah, there's a lot of whining in that first Star Wars. It's very, very true. We love it.
I've always had the headcanon that Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru did themselves in.
Well, I'm never unthinking that.
Set themselves on fire?
It's like, that kid's going to be back any minute now. Let's just do it.
It's like, wow, these don't actually look like Imperial troop markings. It's like, no, no, they are. Wait, who said that? That skeleton just say that? So he manages to stop the Corvette from being put in the crusher. And then we see this class, which, by the way, also features Danny Bonaducci.
Yep, who briefly shows up at the beginning and the end.
Yeah, yeah, as he did in the 70s.
Danny Bonaducci, by the way, for those of you that haven't figured out, the guy who I stole his voice from.
Yeah.
I have Danny Bonaducci's voice. I've ruined it forever. There it is.
And his hair color.
You've been listening to Brian Salisbury and Danny Bonaducci.
Come on, get happy. That's a great reveal right there. So they spend the summer working on this car, and they soup it up. They completely restore it. It is beautiful, except for...
It is now a... Little red Corvette.
Like, very literally. Except for all of the extra spoiler shit they put on top of it that does
Which makes it the most beautiful car in the world.
It makes it look like...
It's a fucking Hot Wheel.
Thank you.
It's a goddamn Hot Wheel. Like, fucking Mark Hamill makes a Hot Wheel and then fucking falls in love with it.
Yeah.
And then chases it all over Las Vegas.
Because they let Danny Bonaducci drive it once, and he comes back from getting them cokes, and someone has stolen the car.
Well, I mean, the thing is they've all been out driving it. They're cruising on a Saturday night. That's their big reward for a job well done at the end of the semester, is they're cruising in the 70s, because... Old man Cargill, that old man Cargill. Before the internet, there was nothing to fucking do. There really wasn't. You guys have no idea how good you have it. Oh, my God. When it was a Friday or a Saturday night, you could either watch really lame television or you could go out. And if you didn't have money or you didn't have anything to do, you went to whatever the drag location was in your town and you drove around. And you'd have these douchebags who drive around in hot cars and randomly pick up girls, because no matter what drag you go to, there's always going to be a couple of girls that... have nothing better to do than want to hang out with guys who have a nice car. And it's the most mystifying thing in the world to be a teenager without a car and watching attractive women get into cars with strange men while you're like, what the fuck, dude?
As true now as it was a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
But so they go to do the drag, and that's what they're doing at the beginning of this film, which I thought was kind of cool. It's like, well, yeah, that's what you did in 1978.
Yeah.
You drove, especially if you built a hot car, you drove around so that people could see you in the car. Now, here's the weird thing about this little Hot Wheel. They built it. He built it with a passenger side drive.
Yeah. So it's like a British car all of a sudden.
Yeah. And I'm curious why they did that. I don't know if you have that detail or not.
According to the IMDb, they did that so that when they shot it, even as Mark Hamill is driving, he could still be close to the curb. So if he needs to interact with anybody on the sidewalk, it's, I guess, better for framing. For framing the shot, that he could just be right. That's what they said, is that the idea that he could, you know, he could cruise down the street, talk to people on the street, and still be driving the car.
So, except that he barely ever in the fucking car.
I'm just telling you what the IMDb told me.
All right.
But yes, this car getting stolen is, it rocks poor Kenny's world. And
his world sucks. And this is what is important about the character. Like, you want to talk about, like, we don't get a lot of time with her, but his mother is awful.
She's the fucking worst.
She is like the stereotypical 70s trailer trash mom. Like, she's a cocktail waitress who apparently dates guys from the club and wanders home randomly at night and is irresponsible enough that she lost her keys, took the spare key, and forgot that that's the key that her son needed to get back in, who's been sitting out all night outside a trailer. Because the biggest logic hole in this movie, there's a lot of logic holes here, biggest logic hole in the movie, this guy can completely tear down and rebuild a car. This guy can steal a car. This guy can't get into a trailer. Like, you know that thing's made of plywood and tin, right?
Yeah.
Like at any time, this genius mechanical expert should be able to get in and out of a trailer or repair any damage that he incurs so he can get inside.
One would think. But yeah.
But then she later on in the film, like when somebody shows up to his trailer to find out where he is, she's packing up because she's moving to Del Mar with some dude and doesn't, my son will find me.
She doesn't even know he's in Vegas.
She has no idea what's up with him.
Where he is and doesn't
care. She doesn't care.
She tells the teacher, like, hey, maybe when you see him, let him know I'm moving. And the fucking teacher's response is amazing because he's like, great. So when I see him, I'll let him know that his mother is moving to Del. Like, he's taking it in and spitting it out with some sarcasm.
He's the only person in his life who cares about him.
Yeah.
Like, there's that really great scene on Graduation where he's, like, kind of dressing him down for being a slack ass in terms of school, but he's like, you've got talent. You can do this. You're great. You know, you don't have to fall into this trap. You don't have to be part of this. And then gives him scotch and drinks a bucket of scotch with him, which is great. Like,
which Cargill will always appreciate.
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, look, it's such a great teacher-student bonding moment. And what that guy does over the course of the movie, even though he's technically one of the bad guys, all through that movie, he cares about this kid.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's one of the glaring weird aspects of this movie is at the end of the day, Mark Hamill's kind of one of the shittiest characters in this movie.
Yeah, but it's weird. The other characters are just shitty enough to make us love Mark Hamill's character. It's a very like,
we feel for him.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you're like, wait, there's this alternate movie here where this guy actually becomes, you know, a master artisan, you know,
fabricator.
But we'll get into this. So let's talk about why, where this goes and why it goes the way it does.
This movie, so he's looking for this car. He gets a tip that this car is on display at a casino in Vegas. And what commences here is what I think makes Corvette Summers such an amazing double feature with Pee-wee's Big Adventure, because it becomes a cross-country quest of one person to find their most prized possession, encountering a lot of wacky characters along the way. Like, I don't for a minute believe that Tim Burton has not seen this movie, because there is so much about Pee-wee's Big Adventure that I see the seeds of in Corvette Summers.
Yeah, this is, and by the way, this is the darker version of that.
Oh, like 100%.
This is, you get the impression looking at the cover and looking at what this is, that this is a light, frilly, maybe teen sex comedy. And it's like, no, this is kind of a dark movie about obsession and falling in with the wrong crowd. Like,
yeah.
Most of the shit that goes on in this movie is kind of fucking dark.
And you're right. The poster looks like a typical boner jam, like a typical like early 80s boner jam. And it's not that at all. Oh,
it's not even remotely that. Like, I mean, there's a little bit of that there. There's some very insensitive stuff going on in this movie, but we'll get to that as well.
This is a love story, but it's a love story in the same way that Christine is a love story, because it's between a boy and his car. That's the love story of this movie. Is that Mark Hamill has an obsessive relationship because this car represents not only the future that he sees for himself, but the one good thing he has in his whole fucking life.
Yeah.
And somebody took it from him.
This is thing I made. I made this. And then somebody came and took it.
Yeah.
They just stole it. They didn't earn it. I fucking earned this. I'm the guy who found this car before it got crushed. I'm the guy that stopped it from being crushed. I'm the guy that came up with these designs. I'm the guy that built this fucking Hot Wheel. And holy fuck, it's my goddamn car. Yeah. And if anybody's going to have that car, it's going to be me.
And I was wrong. It's a 73 Corvette Stingray, not a 76. Just sheathe your tweets. I wanted to get that out of the way. And when he gets to Vegas, one of the first people he meets is...
Well, before he gets to Vegas...
Oh, my God.
One of the most insensitive moments in the movie?
Insensitive and just plain fucking weird bits in this movie is that he's hitchhiking, and the first people to pick him up are a trio, or maybe it's a quartet.
It is a convoy of Vatos.
A convoy of lowriders driven, yes, definitely by Vatos. And they are going about 15 miles an hour.
No, specifically 15 miles.
Specifically 15 miles an
like
hour.
Like that's the whole thing. They pull over and they're, come on in. Yeah, you're welcome. Coolest fucking guys in the world. They're like, absolutely. And then, but for inexplicably, they are driving what is a normally 6-hour drive from Los Angeles to Vegas. They are driving it at 15 miles an hour, meaning it's going to take a whole day to get to Vegas, and he cannot abide by that. I don't know.
What I love about that, though, is that they're driving at the perfect speed to arrive in Vegas just in time to serve their important plot point. Like, it's so well foreshadowed. Like, it's that great kind of, like, you sow the seed and then you reap it in the end of the second act. Like, it's so good. Because, like, they're driving the exact speed that they need to be driving to arrive in that alley to bail out Mark Hamill at a very specific point in this movie. It's so good. I love it. I mean, like, that's kind of the payoff of that bit that I think works really well. But it is a little culturally off the mark, let's just say. And I'm not talking about Hamill. So he decides to not ride with them. So he gets out and he ends up hitchhiking. The next person to pick him up is a girl in a van who calls herself Vanessa, who is traveling to Vegas to go pro at her career.
Which, by the way, in this van, which is a custom van that she got all the custom work done with services rendered.
Yeah. And she keeps dropping that. And Mark Hamill is so wet behind the ears in this movie that he's just like, okay, great. What does that mean? Like, there is.
The whole plot point is she wants to become a prostitute in Vegas. And she has no idea what that really entails or what that is. But for some reason, that's her dream. And they never explain that. They never explain why she wants to become a prostitute.
Maybe because she had the Chevy van. So she's like, we're going to make love in the Chevy van, and that's all right with me. That's what the radio keeps telling me we're supposed to do. Now, and by the way, very, like, entrepreneurial business model that I'm going to be a prostitute who drives around with her own hotel room. Never seen that before. That's kind of interesting. It's like Uber, but for sex. Like, it works. I think that would work. If you had an app for that today, I think it would be gangbusters.
An Appy Potts?
Yeah! Played, of course, by Annie Potts.
Appy Knotts.
Who most of us probably know as Janine from the Ghostbuster movies.
Also from Designing Women.
Wow, we've had two.
Yes. Oh, we have all sorts of weeks. the last three weeks have all been like sewn together with various threads
because it is prophesied. Annie Potts,
prophesied. Corvette.
Callbacks. Yeah, go watch our Damien episode, or go listen to our Damien episode rather. So yeah, the two of them meet up and. She is very much about wanting him to be her first paying customer, and there is something very pure about Mark Hamill in this movie. He is just very uncomfortable with all of the ways of the world, and he is not having it, so she throws him out. He's on the street again, and he's just
living in a U-Haul.
God, it's the saddest fucking thing. He's living inside of, like, a U-Haul, like, pull-behind
trailer. Yeah, trailer. Yeah.
It's so, and he's writing letters to his shop teacher every day. And he's going through these casinos and trying to find, you know, the car that's on display.
And then he finds it early on.
Yes, he finds it. He's
and it's a Fiero.
It's
and he's so offended that not only has he come all this way, but that the guy can't even tell the difference between a Corvette and a Datsun.
Yeah, it's a Datsun. I was gonna say if it was a Fiero, you know, Craig T. Nelson, like, hey, fuck you. But it's a Datsun, and his reaction to that is so great. It's like a Datsun. A Datsun, he's like going to throw up in his mouth. And this obviously another escort is like, hey, maybe we can find your car together. And he just kind of walks away from her, like doesn't even look at her. Like his sole occupation of his mind is to find this car. And then he runs into legendary patron saint of this show.
Oh, yes.
Mr. Dick Miller.
Who gives us the plot point that is never fucking used.
No.
They are handed a plot point that you're like, oh shit, I see what this is. Dick Miller shows up. Dick Miller is the gambler. Dick Miller goes and wins. Like Mark Hamill has had his wallet stolen. He orders just $4 worth of food. He's just starving. Can't pay for it. Dick Miller comes up, makes a bet with the guy.
A coin flip.
And wins Mark Hamill his food, and then just explains to him that I've been on a hot streak for 18 hours, that I cannot lose. I've won everything. I took here, kid, have this. He's like a $2 bill. He's like, that's what I started with. And you're like, oh, Mark Hamill has now been given a magical $2 bill that will, over the course of this movie, send us up. No, it just nothing. Like it ends up on the wall in the van.
It's weird. It actually plays an emotional underscore beat for the relationship between him and Annie Potts, which is kind of creepy because the emotional beat is that she's like, I framed it because you were my first customer. And it's like,
my first paying customer. And it's like, you $2, you're a $2 hooker.
You're literally a $2 whore. Like, I'm not casting aspersions. That is what you have designated for yourself. And it's like, maybe don't show that one to the grandkids. I don't know. It doesn't play the exact plot point you think it's going to. But Dick Miller is everything we want Dick Miller to be in this movie. He's in the movie for about 5.5 seconds.
It's our second Dick Miller of the summer of 78.
Yes. And
because in the summer of 78, you could walk into a movie and just see random Dick Miller.
You know, a little bit of Dick goes a long way.
In fact, it was really great. And I'm like, oh, when he came on, I got excited. And my wife is like, oh, it's that guy. And I'm like, that yes, it is. Miller. Patron saint of junk food cinema.
Hell yeah.
Who are these guys?
By the way, check out the documentary, That Guy Dick Miller, because it's great.
Or so, episode 3 of Junk Food Cinema, where we interview him.
Which I believe is called You Don't Know Dick, because there was a time when all of the episode titles were puns. Believe it! Or not. Tango.
Cash.
Yes, so he is, he's given the $2 bill from Dick Miller. He continues on his quest. And this is, again, so much of this movie is just the people he meets, the trouble he gets into, the jobs he tries to hold down, the jobs Annie Potts tries to hold down.
And we haven't even gotten to the point where Tango and Cash plays into this movie.
That's very true. So he keeps seeing the car. He knows the car's in Vegas. He keeps seeing it on the street. And it's always sort of a comedy of errors, the things that happen to keep him from catching up to it. So it's like this like white whale that's a red Corvette that keeps driving around Vegas. So he's taking up odd jobs. He takes up a job at a gas station where this woman who claims she can't pay for her gas, while he's inside trying to talk the manager out of ripping her off, is outside just stealing shit from the gas station and like loading up and driving away. And she's got like a car full of 3 kids. It's like there's so many little gags like that throughout this movie where you just meet these reprehensible people.
Well, much like Thank God It's Friday.
Yeah.
This is a movie about Las Vegas that hates Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. Like, and this is, and I think this, we should talk about this because this is indicative of the era. We've just come out of the dark 70s. You know, people always talk about how the 70s was some of the greatest filmmaking of all time. And they're kind of right. Mm-hmm. It's just such a great era in which it was such dark times. We had just come out of a tumultuous landscape changing era, much like exactly where we are right now in history, where we had a president that was then taken down and distrust in government bottomed out, and the country had pretty much torn itself apart and then dove into a bottle and snorted and discovered cocaine down there. And all of a sudden, we're still making serious movies, but we're trying to make stuff that's lighter fare. And this movie and TGIF do an interesting job of straddling that line of like, hey, look, this is a fun summer comedy where a guy discovers sex and love and all in Las Vegas while all this other really kind of awful shit happens to him. And that is what this movie is. This movie is, Vegas sucks. And this kid and his obsession is kind of destroying him.
Yeah.
And so ultimately, he finds the car.
Yeah. If Vegas is God, then Mark Hamill is Job for most of this movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because when he finally finds the car and finally finds out what happened to it, it turns out the car was stolen by a group of thieves working with his teacher.
Yeah, it's a really heartbreaking thing because you see him, like the teacher shows up. It's like, oh, he's been writing all these letters. And Mark Hamill's just like, so I tracked it to this garage. And I'm pretty sure that it was this, that. And the teacher's just like, yeah, I know. I even know the name of the guy who wrote. And like the whole time, you as someone who's seen a movie before is like, oh, no, he's in on it. But Mark Hamill's just like, oh, you did some investigating too. He's still so bright-eyed. And like even though this city has done everything to kick him around. In fact, by this point in the movie, we need to talk about, by the time his teacher shows up again to reveal that he's in on it, the gang, when he tracks down the car, he realizes the shop where it's been taken and the people behind it, they kick his ass and like lock him up with the intent to kill him, and he gets away only by virtue of the fact that the lowrider guys show up again. Because in one of the rare instances in a movie where someone... you see this a lot of movies, where someone is locked in a room and they do something to make the guard think they've escaped just so the guard will come into the room. It's a diversion. It's not a real escape. The diversion he comes up with is so much better than the actual escape that he should have just done that. Like, he breaks a window and stacks up some boxes to make the guy think he, you know, climbed up on boxes and broke through the window. And he's actually hiding in an oil drum. But when he pops up out of the oil drum, he leaves a trail of footprints that this guy finds him again and starts to kick his ass again and is only chased away in this alley by the guys in the lowriders who come back, and again, a great payoff. But so this city has done so much to completely destroy this kid's optimism and his sense of self. And yet when this teacher shows up, he's still like, oh, awesome, you did some investigating too, and let's go, you know, we should call the police immediately. And it's like, he's still a kid. He's still an innocent kid. And I think that's why, even though, yes, he does some douchey things in this movie, my heart still kind of goes out to him because he's unflappable. He's fucking unflappable in this movie. But yeah, the teacher shows up, and it turns out the guy who's running the chop shop is a former student of this same, auto shop teacher, and came up with this scheme to where they were going to steal the car, and then the insurance was still going to pay off, and everybody was going to get rich. And it crushes Mark Hamill that his teacher is in on it. It turns him into a different person, and not in the way that you would necessarily anticipate, because Corvette Summer has the Universal Soldier problem, where it's a four-act movie. This movie has four acts.
Yeah.
This movie has the three acts that end with Mark Hamill finding out all the facts. The curtain is pulled back. He knows everything about the theft of this car. And then he starts working for them.
Yeah.
Act four.
Now, by the way, a couple of things to mention. First of all, of the group working there, one of them is Brian James.
Fuck yeah.
Ponytail from Tango. And he doesn't look a day younger.
No.
Like... He looks, it's like, holy shit. Like, he passed quite some time ago, and it's like, oh man, he passed so young. And it's like, no, that guy was around for a while. He looked like that for a long time.
It's so crazy to think this is 4 years before he was in Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
And Blade Runner is probably the thing most people know him from. Like,
no.
Not on this podcast. Like, on this podcast.
Like, yeah, he was also in Blade Runner, but he's also Ponytail. He's also Ponytail. And to be fair, I think Tango and Cash made a lot more than Blade Runner did.
I'm just saying, on his tombstone, it does not say also in Blade Runner.
I disagree.
I can't argue with that. I want to. I would like to for some time.
Yeah, but so he goes to work for him. And here's the thing is that the teacher is making $15,000 a year. And he is like just laying out, hey, look, you got to understand, I make $15,000 a year as a teacher. Like, this sucks. I can't ever get ahead. You can't blame me for this. And so he gets Mark Hamill a job that pays him three times that.
Yeah.
Like, Mark Hamill goes to work at this chop shop doing custom work on these stolen cars for $45,000 a year in 1978.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. That's this kid's fucking dream. So what does he do? He takes the money in advance. He showers Annie Potts with it. He just goes around and has a great time. And then fucks over those guys in the lamest fucking way.
But the thing is, and this is the part of the movie I find really interesting, is that he started, I think you're right, I think it's a movie that hates Vegas. This is the part where Vegas has corrupted him. And he really has become a total rich douchebag.
Yeah, he's a douche canoe.
And the thing is, in his mind, he says something to Annie Potts that is so fucking insulting and degrading, but he doesn't even realize that he's being insulting and degrading, because when they first met, she was all excited about him being a paying customer. So, but by this point, their relationship has blossomed, and she kind of considers you know, them to be together. And he's just like, you know, I can pay you now. Oh, wait, you're worth a lot more than $20. And he thinks that's like a romantic gesture.
Yeah, he thinks I'm in the big time now. I'm no longer a charity case.
Yeah, he thinks paying her for sex is like complimenting her. He just doesn't fucking
care. And that ends up destroying her.
Yeah. And I feel like, yes, it's a douchey thing to do, but there's something very fitting about it based on the character that's been set up, that in his mind, he really thinks he was paying her a compliment. He's that fucking out of touch with the real world. And it's interesting to see how her reaction to that kind of forces him to look in the mirror. And that stealing of the car is him basically being like, no, I'm gonna kind of go back to the me when I first got here and what was driving me and what like my sole concern was. And it's kind of him taking his soul back. Like, I feel like this car represents so many things for this one kid.
Oh yeah.
And so because they've repainted it. They've repainted his red Corvette like a gold color.
And it's really bad.
It's disgusting looking. It looks like the inside of Elvis's bathroom. And it's hideous. So he repaints it red in the middle of the night. And then he does something.
It's a Corvette Trumpster.
It's just a true story. But what I don't understand is why he waits for them to come back. Like, they literally tell him, like, hey, lock up when you're done. He paints the car and then waits in there all night for them to come back to hit them over the head with things to try and get away. And I'm like, you had all night. Just get in the car.
Just get in the car and drive away.
Like, you were right there, man. But of course, that doesn't happen. And one thing I haven't mentioned, Mark Hamill in this movie, how to describe Mark Hamill's look in this movie? He looks like a scarecrow came to life and learned how to drive a truck. That's kind of the Mark Hamill image in this movie. And I remember watching this on this viewing, because I hadn't seen it in a while. I remember watching it on this viewing, and the first thing I thought to myself is, he looks a lot like the guy from Laser Blast. He looks very, very similar to the guy in this terrible fucking 70s movie that many of you probably saw because it was on Mystery Science Theater.
Point of order. The guy in Laser Blast was hired because he looks like Mark Hamill.
And hilariously, who plays the former student who's running the chop shop? The guy from Laser Blast.
My head hurts.
So they're in this movie playing opponents, playing, you know, the antagonist and the protagonist, which is sad because it means we never got to see them in a movie where they were playing brothers, which they should have.
Identical brothers.
Sometimes called twins. Yeah, they should have been in a fucking movie playing brothers. But here, it was just so funny to me. I'm like, he looks like the guy from Laser Blast. Oh, look, there's the guy from Laser Blast. Am I one of the only five people who know what the guy from Laser Blast looks like? Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that. It is my cross to bear. So he's driving away, and this leads to a fourth act car chase. Again, very strange, because the movie's called Corvette Summer. You'd think there would have been more car chases in this movie. But there is one grand, huge car chase at the end of the film.
Those are words I wouldn't use.
No?
Grand and huge in terms of car chase. Two cars, like, driving on empty roads does not a huge car chase make.
I think you could make the argument that there have been lots of great car chases kind of in open terrain. But I will say it is shot like a 70s TV show.
Yes.
Right down to the music, which is all, like, soft rock piano and violins. Like, this week on Corvette Summer. Like, I expected fucking Beretta to be driving one of these fucking cars. It's nuts. But yeah, that I actually don't think it's a bad car chase. I think it's shot actually.
I don't think it's a bad car chase. I just think huge and grand are words I would not use to describe the car chase at the end. It's not badly done, but there's nothing big about it. It's two cars in the desert chasing each other, and Mark Hamill finally outwits the guy.
Yeah, he spends a lot of the By the way, before he engages in this car chase, after he's stolen the Corvette back, he goes and rips Annie Potts out of a porn shoot. And, like, this is the part where I'm like, okay, this doesn't hold up well at all, is that he's dragging her out of the hotel kicking and screaming. And she's like, you don't have the right to do this. I don't want to go with you. And everyone's just looking. Everyone's just like, huh, all right. And he just drags her out of this fucking casino.
Also important to note that in 1978, porn shoots like that were, especially on U.S. soil, were not entirely legal. So that's kind of the idea of she's involved in this illegal activity that he's dragging her out of. So that's he's supposed to be the good guy, because it was totally fine when she was getting beat up by Johns.
Yeah.
Like that illegal activity was okay. But being filmed in a wetsuit in a bathtub in what would eventually be an adult film I'm saving you from this. Also, one of those moments is kind of like, yeah, at the time, this makes sense. Given history, wow.
You've played two.
Wow.
Mark Hamill, you've played two White Knights in the last 2 years. The one on Tatooine is better. Let's just leave it there, shall we? By the way, Annie Potts has some of the best dialogue in this movie.
Yes, she has.
A great joke here where he's like, he says, "I rescued you," and she's like, "You did." And he's like, "You were shooting a porno movie." And he's like, "She's like, no, I wasn't." And he's like, "Well, what would you call it? PG?" And she goes, "No, it was a short." Which I always chuckle at. She's got a lot of great zingers, especially at his expense.
Well, and she has great comic timing. She's just somebody who she knows how to land a joke like that in a way that Mark Hamill never did at the time. You know, Mark Hamill would have said eventually, like, say what everybody loves Mark Hamill. Mark Hamill is one of those guys who had a very rough start. He was in a huge movie, but was never a huge talent. Then went on to become a voice talent and is one of the great voice talents of our era. And then came back to be Space Dad.
And by the way,
and is now just an amazing human being that everybody loves.
By the way, there is a scene, one of the many, you know, dear teacher scenes, but it's just after he's had sex for the first time with Annie Potts, which if you ever wondered what post-coital Mark Hamill ass looks like, Corvette Summers got you covered.
But not him covered.
So he's writing this letter and he's talking about going steady with Annie Potts, and his voice is different. There's something, I think it's intentional, like he feels more like a man, but it's the closest I've ever heard him in a movie sound like the Joker voice that he does in Batman the Animated Series. And I'm like, can you imagine you're a teacher and you get a letter from the fucking Joker? Still no sign of the car, but I'm looking everywhere and I'm going steady with this girl. And it's like, fuck. This is terrifying me. So yes, this all culminates in this car chase where the guy from Laser Blast flips his car, gets frustrated that the horn won't shut off. You think he's going to kill himself? Like the way they frame the shot. He brings the gun and he looks down the barrel, and I'm like, I know 70s movies are all about ending with suicide, but I don't think anything that's happened to this guy warrants a suicide. And then just as you're thinking that, he turns the gun around and shoots his own car so it blows up just so the horn will stop going off. And I'm like, oh, okay, that makes a lot more sense. And then Mark Hamill drives back to the high school.
Because the laser blast guy was the one thing he was really good at was blowing stuff up in the desert.
This is true. And we find out that he is still good at that. So Mark Hamill drives the car back to his high school. And I think this is the moment where he realizes that there's more to life than, you know, just this car. And he actually gives it back to the school. And that fucking shop teacher is a great moment where he says, like, say the thing I need to hear, which is I'm not going to tell anybody. He doesn't tell anybody, but he also doesn't give him the satisfaction of, you know, knowing that he's off the hook. It's such a great fucking moment for this kid.
And then Danny Bonaducci shows up again.
Danny Bonaducci shows up and it's like, here's your diploma. I'm not really in this movie. And then Mark Hamill just chases after Annie Potts. I think that the two of them together are really sweet. And the ending of the fourth act is that Mark Hamill has discovered real love. And he's no longer, again, not unlike the ending of Christine, where it's like, I will be in love with a real person and not a car.
Yeah.
The end.
And that's Corvette Summer.
Yeah, and it's one of these movies where, again, I think the characters and the specific arc that he has and the fact that it reminds me so much of Pee-wee's Big Adventure, like, there's so much about this movie that I love, and it was great to revisit it. There are some troubling things for sure. But in terms of something we like to talk about a lot, which is headcanon, so much of the plot of this movie could have been set on Tatooine. Like, if you think about it, this movie absolutely could have been a Luke Skywalker story.
So Luke rebuilds this land speeder.
Yep.
And it gets stolen while he's in Mos Eisley. Well, it gets stolen out
while he's
near his farm
station
at Tashi Station, and then he has to go to Mos Eisley,
which is the Vegas of Tatooine.
Yeah, to find, you know, you'll never find a greater hive of scum and villainy than Las Vegas. And while he's out there, you know, befriends a droid in a van.
Yep, and a pleasure droid.
A pleasure droid. Mm-hmm. And yeah, no, I'm stopping here. Stopping here.
Wait, wait, wait. But then it turns
before
out...
Before we get to fuck 2D2, I just...
R2DP? Oh. Yeah.
See my titsio?
Oh, God damn it!
It turns out the speeder has been stolen by the local criminal element, so he goes up against the Hutts. Like, there's so much about this movie that could just be the fucking Luke Skywalker spinoff. Like, I enjoy it on that level as well. But, yeah, I think you're right. Corvette Summer probably should have been the movie we kicked this off with. The Corvette Summer of 78.
Disturbing.
And that brings us to the junk food pairing, which, throughout this movie, they keep visiting this fast food place. And at one point, Mark Hamill's exact order is an everything dog, a diamond dog, a large fry, and a cherry lime... Hold on, I want to get this correct. A cherry lime Ricky, which I assume is just a cherry limeade. But he calls it a cherry lime Ricky. So I want to know, Cargill, if you had to come up with something that you would call a diamond dog, what would be on a diamond... I'm very fascinated by this idea of what is on a diamond dog that would make it specific on that menu, make it like the house special. I'm at a loss.
I would think that a diamond dog might be covered with chopped onions.
Like really small diced
like
onions?
Like the diced onions.
Yeah.
Like that's what makes it the diamond dog is the diamond shaped, you know,
okay.
Onions sprinkled all over it.
I could totally get behind that. Again, I think because of the diet, they keep going to this fucking restaurant and it made me so hungry every single time. And there's also a lot of... Like, Coca-Cola, I don't know if they paid money to be in this movie, but they are all over this fucking movie. Like, there's literally a point where Danny Bonaducci is carrying a tray of about 20 Coca-Cola cups, so...
Yeah, I don't know, but it gets to the point where it's like, but I went to get the Cokes. I didn't want a Coke!
I'm not thirsty! Like, oh my God, the one moment of completely
unhinged. When Mark Hamill just loses it.
Whoa!
And crumples a paper cup of Coke.
You like have
badass.
Break out a lightsaber and be like, no! Just start like whacking at Danny Bonaducci.
It's not true!
It's impossible! I prefer Pepsi!
Well, that is impossible.
I'm a Pepsi drinker, like my father before me.
Is Pepsi okay? No!
No. It's not good. Anyway, that's Corvette Summer. Thanks so much for coming along on this ride with us. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Massawyrm, MASSAWYRM.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also follow the show at Junk Food Cinema. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like the show...
I mean really like the show.
If you like the show as much as Mark Hamill apparently doesn't care for Coca-Cola, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema for as little as $1 a month. You financially support the show, keep the lights on here at Junk Food HQ, and we greatly appreciate it. And until next time, I want to remind you that Repo Man knows that a Corvette is the hardest to steal.